I saw a cartoon the other day entitled Low Self-Esteem that showed a man drowning, at risk of drowning, arms flailing in the water as he shouts out to those on shore saying, "Help if you're not too busy." I had to chuckle because I can relate to that. It makes me really uncomfortable to ask people for help. Oh, I'll just do it myself. All of which makes me a really bad pastor when it comes time to lead a stewardship campaign. I hate to ask for money, which is kind of awkward, because right now here at Life Journey Church, we happen to be in the midst of a season of stewardship awareness, and I find myself shy about asking. Now, some pastors are really good at this. They pull out the heavy artillery. I read about a pastor who stood up in front of his congregation and said, "There's somebody here today who's done some pretty disgusting stuff. And if he doesn't put a $10 bill in the offering plate today, his name will be read from the pulpit next Sunday." When they counted the offering that day, there were 29 $10 bills in the offering. And a $5 bill with a note attached saying, "I'll give you the other half on payday." If only I had that kind of chutzpah. But I don't. So instead, let me simply say, if you believe in what God is doing through this church, please prayerfully consider the stewardship insert in your worship bulletin today. Before church, two Sundays ago, Pat Mosier walked in and said to me, "Today is my 80th birthday." I said, "Oh, congratulations. What a milestone that is." She said, "I hope to live to be 91 years old." I said, "91? Why 91? You know, why not round it off? 95, 90? She said, "I've got a lot of stuff left to do." She went on to tell me that she volunteers at a hospice. She said, "I love what I do. I'm passionate about it." I said to her, "Pat, it's hard for me to imagine a way of being Jesus to others in the world that is more powerful than being a midwife who helps shepherd people through their transition from this life to the next." I said, "You have such a powerful ministry." She said, "You know, I haven't really thought about it that way." Later, as I walked on into the worship service, I found myself thinking, that's why what this church does is so important. Every Sunday, Pat Mosier comes here and gets replenished spiritually so that she can then go out and share that spiritual energy, being Jesus to dying people. And every one of us who gives to this church has what you might call a spiritual investment share in Pat Mosier's ministry to the dying. Because we give to this church, it creates this space where Pat can come replenish her soul so that she has the spiritual energy to go out and be Jesus to dying people. So each donor here has a fractional spiritual investment share in her ministry to the dying. Take that, multiply that times 350 regular attenders at this church, and you can begin to imagine the potential that's in a spiritual community like ours as each one of us goes out into the world to be Jesus to others who are around us. That's why what we do here is so critically important. And if you believe in what God is doing through this church, please prayerfully consider the insert in our worship bulletin today. But now, let's shift gears and turn our attention to the topic for today's sermon, starting with a prayer. Jesus, our goal is to become more like you. For each one of us here to be growing more fully into our own unique Christ-likeness, so that your kingdom can come and your will be done on this earth as it is in heaven. Encourage and challenge us today as we wrestle with a critical teaching point that you, Jesus, made in your Sermon on the Mount. For it's in your holy name we pray. Amen. Did you know that according to Jesus, the standard by which you will be judged has not yet been set? Let that sink into your soul. Did you know that according to Jesus, the standard by which you will be judged may not be the same standard by which I am judged? That God's standard for judging us is malleable, customized to each one of us. In fact, did you know that according to Jesus, you get to choose the standard by which you will be judged? You may be sitting there thinking, Jeff, what are you saying? You sound like a heretic. Where are you getting this? Straight from the words of Jesus in today's gospel passage, it is imperative that we let these words fully penetrate our hearts, because if they are true, the ramifications of the words in today's gospel passage for each one of us are huge. Jesus said, Matthew chapter 7, verse 1, "Do not judge, so that you may not be judged. For with the judgment you make, you will be judged. And the measure you give will be the measure you get." That's pretty clear, isn't it? No ambiguity there. Picture, if you will, in your mind's eye, a continuum of judgment that ranges all the way from really harsh up to amazingly merciful. With each judgment that you make of another person, you are moving the needle on that continuum up or down, so that over the course of time, a pattern begins to develop that sets, if you will, your average judgment score. You've probably seen these television commercials that ask, "What's your sleep number?" By which they mean, do you prefer a firmer or a more soft mattress, right? Here's our question for today. What is your judgment number? Where on this continuum do you typically fall? Because wherever you set that needle, that is precisely where the needle will be set when God is judging you. You get to choose. Let that sink into your soul today. Late one night, an old man who's obviously had too much to drink gets on a bus, staggers back the aisle of the bus, plops down in a seat next to a little old lady who is dutifully reading her Bible. She looks up, quickly assesses the situation, and with a tone of contempt says to him, "Mister, I've got news for you. You're going straight to hell." With that, the old man jumps up out of his seat and says, "Oh man, I got on the wrong bus again." Come judgment day, I wouldn't want to be that woman. In fact, even right now, I wouldn't want to be her, because you see, this is not just about judgment day. Yes, on judgment day, after our lives are over, there will surely come a point in time when God makes a summary judgment of the span of our lives. But in between now and then, all along the way, surely God is making a number of intermediate judgments of our life. Not just that, but other people are also judging us. And guess what? The more harshly I judge the people around me, the more harshly they are apt in turn to judge me. Not just that, but the more harshly I judge the people around me, psychology teaches us, the more harshly I am apt to even judge myself. About 7 years ago or so, I still had an elderly black lab who was the sweetest, kindest, gentlest, most timid, easily frightened dog I've ever had. She was very attached to me, and I would take her most everywhere I went, including here to church. During the week, she would sleep under my desk. And then at lunchtime, I would take her out for walks. On one particularly beautiful, temperate, sunny fall afternoon, I took her for an extra long walk at lunch. As we were coming back toward the church building, cutting across the upper parking lot up here, with the church in sight, somewhere in the middle of that parking lot, she just suddenly plopped down on her belly, tail wagging, looking up at me. I said, "Mercy," that was her name, "Mercy, come on." Tugged on the leash a little bit, she wouldn't budge. I said, "Mercy, I've got things to do, come on." Tugged, she wouldn't move. Tugged again, wouldn't. So I start to raise my voice, "Mercy, I said, move." Wagging tail, looking up at me. Then I got a bright idea. I unhooked the leash and started walking toward the church building, figuring that she would follow me. Got to the edge of the parking lot, turned, looked back. She was still laying in that same spot, tail wagging, looking at me. By now, my dander is starting to get up. I marched back to where she was. I reattached the leash. And I said, "Come on." She wouldn't budge. "Mercy." I'm getting louder and louder. Finally, I take my open hand and I give her a swat on the behind and say, "Move." She doesn't move. I had to scoop that 60-pound dog up in my arms and carry her about 100 feet back to the church building. When I got back to the church building, put her inside, I gave her another little swat on the behind for good measure. I was mad. 5 minutes later, I'm thinking, "Oh, why did I do that? She's so timid. She's so easily frightened." I turned around and I said, "Mercy, I'm so sorry." As fate would have it, about a week later, suddenly and unexpectedly, she passed away. Since then, many times I've thought to myself, I wonder if she had some kind of mystical premonition that our time together was growing short. I wonder if she was laying there, if she was on the parking lot, if she was thinking, "Hey, Dad, we don't have that much time left together. Let's just spend a little extra time out here today." Sometimes I just stop and look up to heaven and say, "Mercy, forgive me." Because the truth is, I struggle to forgive myself for that. Why did I do that? And there you have it. With the same judgment as you make, you will be judged. Not just by God or others, but even by ourselves. Harsh judgment is toxic to the one who's judged and to the one who does the judging. For the measure you give will be the measure you get. That's the bad news. But there's also good news, because the reverse is also true. If harsh judgment begets harsh judgment, then it's also true that merciful judgment begets mercy. On November the 4th, 2002, several Long Island teenagers went into a grocery store and purchased a 20-pound frozen turkey, not to eat, but because they had a practical joke in mind. They were going to play a prank. They got in their vehicle and were driving down a highway on Long Island when Ryan Cushing, 18 years old, heaved the frozen turkey out the window of their vehicle. As fate would have it, that turkey smashed into the windshield of the vehicle directly behind them, went through the windshield, and crashed into the face of Victoria Ruvalo, breaking every bone in her face. Several weeks later, she awakened in the hospital completely unaware of what had happened to her. She says in her own words, "When I looked in the mirror, I could see it was me, but my whole face was smashed in and every single bone was broken. I had no idea I'd had 10 hours of surgery, and I was shocked when the doctors told me that from now on, for the rest of my life, I'd always have 3 titanium plates in my left cheek, 1 in my right cheek, and I'd also have a wire mesh holding my left eye in place because my left eye socket was so badly shattered." A year later, it came time for Ryan Cushing's trial. Victoria writes this: "On the day we went to court, I see this young man walk in wearing a suit which looked like it was 3 times too big for him. It made him look so frail. He walked in with his head hung down. He looked so upset with himself. When I saw him, my heart went out to him. To me, he looked like a lost soul." Ryan Cushing was facing the potential of 25 years in prison. Until Victoria Ruvalo stood up and asked to address the judge. She told the judge, "I don't want him to go to prison. If you put him in prison, he'll only become a more hardened criminal. I don't want to see him rot in prison. Please have mercy on him." Moved by what Victoria said, the judge decided to give Ryan Cushing 6 months in prison and 5 years probation. After the hearing that day, Ryan walked over to the table where Victoria was sitting, his head hung down, tears streaming down his cheeks. He said to her, "I'm so sorry. I didn't mean it to happen this way. I pray for you every day." At that point, she says, "My motherly instincts took over." She stood up, she put her arms around him, she held him as he wept. She said to him, "It's going to be okay. Just do something good with your life. I just want you to make something good of your life." And he did. Throughout his 5 years of probation, he worked with a nonprofit ministering to at-risk youth. After his probation, he continued working with that organization, ministering to at-risk youth, because he who had received mercy now wanted to share that mercy with others like him who were at-risk youth. Come judgment day, Victoria Ruvalo will someday find herself standing before Jesus, and the books will be opened, and the worst things that Victoria Ruvalo has ever done will be called to remembrance, and Jesus will look her in the eye and say to her, "With the judgment that you made toward Ryan Cushing, I will now judge you. You are forgiven, completely forgiven. Enter into the joy of your Lord." There is power, beauty, healing, and freedom when we finally lay down the heavy burden of our harsh judgments toward others and let go of our right to demand an eye for an eye. Jesus calls us to become more compassionate judges, not just for the sake of those whom we might judge, but for our own sake, for our own well-being. So, how can we do that? How can we become more compassionate judges? As we start to wind down today, I want to offer three suggestions in hopes that at least one of these suggestions will resonate with each one of us here today so that each one of us can hopefully carry away at least one thing today that can help make us a more compassionate judge. The first of these three suggestions comes directly from the words of Jesus in today's gospel passage as he continues by saying in verse 3, Matthew 7:3, Jesus says, "Why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye, tiny little speck, but do not notice the log, the big honking log in your own eye? Or how can you say to your neighbor, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' while the huge log is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye." The point here obviously being that I take a giant step toward becoming a more compassionate judge when I begin to get in touch with the magnitude of my own flaws, the logs that are in my own eye. Frederick II was a 19th century king in Prussia who was known as something of a reformer. One of his reform initiatives was prison reform. Supposedly, there came a day when Frederick II was touring one of his prisons to see how things were going. And as he toured the prison, literally every prisoner he encountered fell to his knees, pleaded his case, and insisted on his complete innocence. All of the prisoners, except one who remained silent. Intrigued, Frederick asked the silent prisoner, "How about you? What are you in here for?" "Armed robbery, Your Majesty." "Are you guilty?" "Absolutely, Your Majesty. I richly deserve my punishment." At which point Frederick rapped his scepter on the stone floor and said, "Warden, release this guilty wretch immediately. I won't have him in this jail corrupting all the splendid innocent folk who inhabit it." It's how we are, right? We look at ourselves and we see innocence. We can rationalize anything we do. We look at others and we are quick to judge. We can see how guilty they are. I saw a funny photograph the other day that looks like this. It's a little blurry up here, but I'll explain it to you. It pictures a typical milk cooler in a typical convenience store. But on the front of the cooler door, they've hung a sign that says, "This is not an exit." The caption beneath the photo read, "There must be a really good story behind this." You can imagine, right? Somebody comes in, a little too much to drink, trying to get out of the store, tries to exit through the milk cooler. It must have been a funny story. Truth is, every one of us has done stuff that embarrasses us. Every one of us is guilty of something. We've all got stuff that we need to be working on. And when I begin to get in touch with that, the magnitude of my own flaws, it drains all the energy out of my righteous indignation toward others and causes me to want to say, "God, have mercy on us all. God, if you will show me mercy, I will share that mercy with others." A while back, the Louisville Courier Journal did a human interest story on a man named Rob Schmitty, who one day was searching on the internet when he happened to stumble across someone who needed a kidney donation. "As I sat there," he told the Courier Journal, "I found myself thinking, I want to do something that will make my children proud." So he did it. He donated a kidney to a complete stranger. But that's where the story takes an unexpected twist. The article went on to say that Rob's 10-year-old daughter, Amber, wasn't much impressed by what her dad did. She told the Courier-Journal, "He never visits, he never calls, not even on my birthday. If you ask me," she said, "he's not much of a hero." Turns out, Rob Schmitty was 9 months behind on his child support payments. And there you have it. The tension that exists in every human life. On the one hand, we can be so beautiful, while at the very same time, being so utterly rotten. Same person, two natures. Who am I to judge anybody? Yeah, I've got some beautiful stuff I do. But the truth is, there's some rottenness in me. Flaws. Things that I need to work on. And when I start to get real about that, when I start to get honest with myself about the magnitude of my own flaws, it begins to drain all the energy out of my righteous indignation and makes it much more intuitive for me to become a compassionate judge. This is the first of the three suggestions. How can I become a more compassionate judge of others? It begins, according to Jesus, with getting in touch with the magnitude of my own flaws. Suggestion number one. Suggestion number two comes from 1 Corinthians 4:7, a fascinating verse penned by the Apostle Paul that really challenges me and makes me think. 1 Corinthians 4:7 is worded this way: "Who says that you're better than other people? What do you have that wasn't given to you? And if you were given what you have, why are you bragging as if it weren't a gift?" You see the point that's being made there? Suppose, for example, you are tempted to judge somebody for still having their Christmas decorations up. Just to pick a random hypothetical example. Who are you to judge me? Yes, our Christmas tree is still up. Our goal is to have it down by Cinco de Mayo. If we're lucky, God help us. Let me use a more significant example. Suppose I am tempted to judge somebody who can't seem to keep a relationship. Oh, they are in and out of relationships all the time. What's the matter with them? I mean, look at me. I've been married for 30 years. But then 1 Corinthians 4:7 slaps me in the face and says, "Hey, Jeff, your marriage was a gift. You didn't earn that." I protest. I say, no, I've worked really hard to build a 30-year marriage. But 1 Corinthians 4:7 says to me, "Really? Where did you learn to be in long-term relationship? Was it you, Jeff, who decided who your parents were going to be? Parents who beautifully modeled for you a 65-year marriage, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health? Because let me tell you something, it gives you a real advantage. If you grew up watching parents who really got this, who had a sacrificial love and commitment for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, I didn't pick my parents. My parents were a gift to me. And watching them, that really gives a person an advantage." It wasn't my choice. It was God's husband, who also had been gifted with that. It takes a lot of patience to be successful in a marriage, and I've got many, many flaws. You know them well. One of my few strengths is I am patient. Patient to a fault. But then along comes 1 Corinthians 4:7, slaps me in the face and says, "Where'd you get that patience from?" Science teaches us that our personality traits are predominantly created by nurture and nature, DNA, some combination of DNA and formative life experiences. Did I choose my DNA? No, it was a gift to me. Did I get to choose my formative experiences in life? No, they were thrust upon me. And so if some combination of nurture and nature came together to make me strong in the area of patience, do I have any right to brag about that and judge others who've not been given the same gifts? No. On top of that, I've been given a husband who is amazingly patient. What a gift that is. Because but for that, I would have been divorced years ago, because I am a very difficult person to live with. I know you can't imagine that, but I am a very difficult person to live with. My 30-year marriage is the product of gift after gift after gift after gift that I did not earn, but were given to me. You can take any strength in your life and analyze it through the lens of 1 Corinthians 4:7 and reach the same conclusion. What do you have that wasn't given to you? And if you were given what you have, why are you bragging as if it isn't a gift and judging those who have different gifts? This is the second suggestion. How can I become a more compassionate judge? I become more compassionate intuitively when I get in touch with the magnitude of my own flaws, number one, and number two, when I get in touch with the fact that every good thing that I have in me has been given to me as a gift. Finally, lastly, third suggestion. I become a more compassionate judge when I realize how much I don't know about others and their situations. Years ago, before the war in Afghanistan, Barbara Walters, then a correspondent for ABC News, traveled to Afghanistan to do a story on the repression of women under the Taliban regime there. Among other things, women in Afghanistan were forced to walk 5 paces behind their husbands in public. The Taliban was a brutal patriarchal regime. Barbara interviewed several women there who were working to change that. And then years later, after the Afghan war was over and the Taliban was overthrown, she went back to do a follow-up story, was startled to see that women were still customarily walking 5 paces behind their husbands. She interviewed one of the women she had talked to before. She said, "I don't understand. You worked so hard to change this. Why now do you happily walk 5 paces behind your husband?" The woman smiled slyly and said to her, 2 words, landmines. The moral of the story being, there's a lot more to most situations than meets the eye. The situations we encounter in life are far more complicated than we would think, and there is nothing worse than a judge who forms a judgment on incomplete information. There is no way I can judge you accurately because I don't know you well enough. Even if I've lived with you for 30 years, I am not you. I have not had your formative experiences. I don't know what it means to be you. I don't have a basis for making accurate judgments of you. Only God Almighty does. Years ago, when she was popular, Ann Landers, an advice columnist in newspapers, published a letter that she had received from a grocery store clerk who was complaining that she often saw people on food stamps going through her grocery store line and using those food stamps to pay for what she called luxury items, things like pre-made birthday cakes and bags of shrimp. The woman in her note to Ann Landers said that people who do that, she thinks, are lazy and wasteful. A couple weeks later, Ann devoted her entire column to letters responding to what the grocery clerk had said. The last letter that Ann quoted from was from a woman who wrote this. She said, "I am that woman who bought the $17 cake and paid for it with food stamps." I thought the checkout clerk was going to burn a hole through me with her eyes. What she didn't know is that the cake was for my little girl's birthday. It will be her last. She has bone cancer and will probably be gone in 6 to 8 months. Oh, that changes things, doesn't it? God, forgive me for my foolish judgments. Who am I to judge anybody? Not even myself. Only God is equipped to do that. Let me close with this. Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson is someone who became famous as a professional wrestler. as you're probably aware, and then went on to become famous as a movie star. He also happens to have a famous father who himself was a groundbreaking professional wrestler, Rocky Soul Man Johnson, who was the first African-American man to break the color barrier in professional wrestling. Recently, Rocky Soul Man Johnson died suddenly, unexpectedly, of a heart attack. Dwayne Johnson gave the eulogy at his father's funeral. I want to share with you a few words from Dwayne Johnson's eulogy for his father. "Dad," he said, "you lived a full and meaningful life. I love you. You broke color barriers, became a ring legend, and trailblazed your way through this world. I was the boy sitting in the seats, watching and adoring you, my hero from afar. The boy you raised to always be proud of our cultures and proud of who and what I am. You trailblazed, and even harder, you changed people's harsh behaviors toward a man of color, paving the way for me, my family, and generations to come. You loved us with the capacity of which you could, given all the givens. Raised me with an iron hand and a tough, complicated love. A love that now, as a father, I've learned to refine as I raise my own children. I wish I had one more shot to say one more thing. You were taken too fast, slipped right through my hands. I'll see you down the road, soul man. Go rest high on that mountain till we meet again, your son." What struck me about those words are these excerpts. "I was the boy sitting in the seats, watching and adoring you, my hero from afar. You loved us with the capacity of which you could, given all the givens. Raised me with an iron hand and a tough, complicated love, a love that now as a father I've learned to refine. I hear a lot of hurt beneath those words. That's what makes this so beautiful. That Dwayne Johnson was able to genuinely love and honor his father while also being honest about his father's flaws and holding those flaws gently. That's what Jesus is calling us to become more compassionate judges, because the judgment that you make is the judgment you will get. The measure you give is the measure you will get. What's your judgment number? God, help us all to become more compassionate judges.